Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Let us begin. The plan is today to finish up with Rav Chaim Ozer Gazinsky, and I don't know if we'll be able to speak. Start with Eliel Ben Amozig, but if not, certainly next class. I did want to just pick up something that we ended last class in the questions. Someone asked me really completely off the topic, but I'm happy to answer it. I believe it was Shlomo officials, who I, officialists I don't see here now. But I asked me about, and I spoke a bit about Isidore Tursky, Professor Isidore Yitzhak Tursky, son-in-law of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Complicated person. Here is a picture of him. And, of course, what makes it complicated is that this is the picture as I knew him in the late 1980s, 1990s, until his death in 1997. But if I were to show you a picture of him from... If I'd show you a picture of him from 1970, 75, or 1960s, he didn't look at all like this. So when you think of the tall Nerebi, Rav Yitzhak Tursky, and you think of him as this picture, it's not like this was him from his youth on. He was a counselor at Yavna, New Hampshire, and he was very much of a Haskalah type of personality to a large extent. Religious, obviously, Haskalah personality, but he is a very complicated person. I just on my trip in Israel, which I came back from a few weeks ago, I found letters of his. There's letters of him to Gershom Scholem and others in beautiful Hebrew, even I would say Hasidic rabbinic Hebrew. But biography of him or the study of his life has not been written. There's not even an article on his views, but. So that I don't have anything more to say other than if I were to speak about my own personal relationship with him. As I mentioned, for about 5 years, I was with him almost every single day. So there is what to say, and you could have an interesting article, the difference between the university would often have close relationship with the university professors, and in a certain extent it models. It's parallel to the relationship between a Rebbe Talmud, but there are significant differences in how you relate to a professor than how you relate to a traditional Rebbe. And the Tursky situation was that he was between a Rebbe and a professor. So maybe another time I'll speak a little bit more about him. Well, how did he go from chassid to professor? The question is how he went from professor to chassid. He grew up the son of the Tolna Rebbe, who was the Hasidish Rebbe. And, I mean, I could show you, I don't have pictures here but I, on the screen, but I could show you pictures of him, I'll bring up again, of with his father, who was a real Rebbe. And, but he, in his youth, he never went to yeshiva. He went to the Boston Latin School. Growing up in Boston, there aren't that many religious people in Boston, so getting to know the Rav's family and the Rav's daughter was obviously something you'd expect, and obviously they hit it off, and they married, and he lived as an academic until his father passed away, and then he took over the shul. So he became the Tolna Rebbe. So Tolna Rebbe, who happens to have a PhD from Harvard and went to Boston Latin, and he only learned on his own with his father, and he learned with his father-in-law a lot. And he spent a lot of time in Israel. He was in Israel, I believe, in 1949 already. So spent a lot of time there. But his life was really in the academic world, and then he becomes the rabbi of the shul, so then he's also in the rabbinic world, but never took a public role. So in a sense, he left the Hasidic world to join the academic world, really the modern Orthodox world. And that shul, by the way, in which they said the prayer for the state of Israel and everything, although he functioned as a Rebbe with the kapata and the gartel and everything, the shul itself was a shul of, I think there's only one other guy with a strimal during my time there, it was a shul of modern academics, and yet many of them looked to Tursky as a Rebbe of a sort. So it was they were his chassidim of a different type of chassidim. That's what I will say about the late Rabbi Dr. Professor Tursky. A couple of you emailed me, asked me to just, maybe I did it too quickly, to elaborate a bit on what I said about from Rabbi Abadi's new sefer about opening a refrigerator on Shabbos with the light going on. So it's obviously an issue that many people have. My whole life I grew up, we didn't have that light in the refrigerator. Never had that problem, and I guess it's dark, a little dark, but you get used to it, so you don't need it because you have the light from the kitchen. But when I married my wife 10 years ago, she wanted the light on. That to her was a big deal. So, it's been 10 years, and I can say that in 10 years, not once have I forgotten to turn the light off. Every Erev Shabbos, about 2 hours before Shabbos, when I come up and do what I need to do, that's one of the things I do. But I assume one day it's going to happen that I forget. And so if you look in the post scheme, there's different opinions on this. You can ask your local Rav. I'm curious what he says, and then you can get back to me. I think a pretty standard view is that, well, they all say in the written literature, you can ask a non-Jew to open it up to get the food. How often do you have a non-Jew around to do these sorts of things? I guess if you have a non-Jewish neighbor. I've never seen anyone say you can ask a katan, a minor, to do it, although that could be an answer. Some say that you can open it with a shinoi, and then you can let it just let go of it, and if it closes on its own, fine. Others say you can't close it, though. You can close it not all the way, so the light doesn't go off. So Rabbi Badi's conclusion was very different, as I said, that you can open it. And the logic is problematic, though, because he says that it's a pesik resha d'lo nichalei. That is, it's something that happens automatically that you don't really care about. Now, I understand what that means in terms of closing the refrigerator. Close the refrigerator, you don't care if the light goes off. But how is opening it a pesik resha d'lo nichalei? You want the light to go on. And it's not like when, and this is why I asked his son about this, and he said, well, it's like if you're walking on the street, you don't need to move if the light's going to go on. But that's different because that's not your light, that's someone else's light that they put in front of their garage. So it's a bit of a problem. And by the way, also, this idea that p'sik resha d'lo nichalei, on Shabbos, we don't need to be concerned about it. I don't know if that's a standard view. That's the Brisker view. If you look at Nefesh HaRav, he quotes from Soloveitchik as saying that is that in rabbinic prohibition, you don't have to be concerned with it. But I don't know if everyone holds that way. So in any event, I was struggling over this responsum, and I called Rabbi Baruch Simon. Baruch Simon is a Rosh Yeshiva at YU, a real genius, if any of you know him. He doesn't have the internet. All the stuff in his writings are simply from his own knowledge. Any day you go to the YU library, you will see him sitting there with plenty of svarim. He's published about 4 or 5 svarim now. And he's a big chassid of Rav Abadi. He even takes a shiur there every year to go see him. So I was curious, so I called him up, I know him. And he said that he discussed this very tshuva with Rabbi Abadi, and Rabbi Abadi told him that he was told by others not to publish this because it's radical. And Rabbi Abadi explained to him why it's not a psik reshid ol nichalei, that basically we don't put the light in, and we'd buy the refrigerator if the light wasn't in. He gave him a whole explanation that I have to say, I don't really buy it. It doesn't make that much sense to me, but you should know that a great Talmud Chacham has written this, and when it wants further details, I guess you can ask Rabbi Simon. Tell him I told you to ask him, and he can explain it to you. Oh, that's interesting, Yossi. I didn't know that. But I don't understand. What do you mean, wait for the motor to stop? Oh, I see. Wait, the motor stops, then you unplug it. Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know about that. Okay, that's an answer, although I don't know. It seems to me, at least my refrigerator, it never stops. It always goes. And when refrigerators were first invented, there was questions, can you open it or not, because you start the motor sooner with the air, all these things. And pretty much everyone concluded that you can open it anytime you want to open it. It's where when hot air comes in. I cause the air conditioning to start sooner, but I don't know. It's I don't see my refrigerator very much of a difference. Okay. A few more things before we start with Rav Chaim Ozer. I want to call your attention to something very interesting. In the Chazon Ish's book, Emuna U'Bitachon, there's actually an English translation of it now, which I got. And this is an interesting translation because it has in the back, for the first time ever published, the censored sections of Emuna U'Bitachon, although for some reason he doesn't translate them. If you look on page 144, and this is chapter, he doesn't divide the chapters, so I don't know which one it is. The Chazon Ish writes about, he's trying to talk about Emuna in Chachamim, and he says that if you have a situation where the people are electing a rabbi, and each one finds fault with the other's candidates, should listen to the decision of the Torah leaders of the generation. I don't think there's any question that this is a reference to the controversy over the Feinmoser versus Rubinstein. We know at the time that the Chazon Ish was very involved in this. He got the other Gedolim involved. It makes perfect sense that he would refer to this in his writings, at least obliquely here. And this also helps date Emunah Bitachon, when it was written. So, okay, I have a few more things. An interesting tshuva about from Avad Yosef, where he permits a conversion by a conservative rabbi. I will get to that the next time. I want to now go to Rav Chaim Moser so we can finish today. But before we go to, I want to say one more thing. Who censored it? Well, when Emunah Bitachon was published by the family, they censored it, and someone got a hold of it about 10 years ago and published it, and now the cat is out of the bag. So I think in the next edition will be published. The reason why it was censored was because it has very strong criticism of the Mussar movement, I think in particular in Bardic. Which it's ironic because, maybe not ironic, if you look at Chaim Grada, the yeshiva, that's precisely the conflict there between the Chazon Ish's vision of Judaism and the Navardic vision. The last thing I want to show you, only because we discussed this in the past, is this picture. We dealt with Ramosha Feinstein, we dealt with certification of whiskey. And here you have an ad that appeared the back page of the Jewish Week. As far as I know, this is the first OU certified kosher whiskey. Here's my prediction. And if we're still on the air in 10 years, you can test it. My prediction is that in 10 years, all the major whiskeys will be under Hashgacha. And not only that, any event certified by any of the local VODs, any of the shuls, they will only carry Hashgacha whiskey. And in 30 years, the younger generation will be old people, and we'll be telling the younger generation that when we were in our day, we would drink any whiskey, and it didn't matter what the whiskey was, and there wasn't such any hashkacha on any of these whiskeys, Southern Comfort or the rest of them, and the people, the youngsters, are not going to believe us. They're going to say, no, it's not true. And then when we finally convince them, they'll write about how, well, that's because in our day, people were not so mocked on kashrus, and therefore they felt that they didn't need to have hashkacha, but now we know better. So, mark my word, that's coming. And I did originally, when we dealt with Ramosha Feinstein, I said that they could not force this through because the Hasidim would never, the Litvisha maybe would go along with changing their standards, but the Hasidim, you can't tell the Hasidim that what their Rebbe is drinking is not kosher. Just like you couldn't tell the modern Orthodox that non-glot wasn't kosher. But what you do is you can attack it from the supply side. Because there's no demand for this, you go on the supply side and you convince the companies, you do what you have to do, so you create a situation where the only whiskey in the world basically will be Hashgacha whiskey, just like they created a situation where the only meat in America, not in Israel, meat everywhere is non-glot, but you create a situation where the only meat in America considered reliably kosher is glot, and therefore, willy-nilly, to use a word that the Rav used to use, everyone becomes glot kosher. The same thing, willy-nilly, because the supply will all become hashgacha. Therefore, now it'll become the new standard that whiskey can only be accepted if it has hashgacha. Mark my word, in 10 years, this is what we will see. And if any of you can put it in your calendar, in 10 years, it'll probably be in the 17th century of our discussions, and we will come back to this. Yes, maybe Yaakov, they will do that. So let's go on to Rav Chaim Moser. I want to begin by answering one more time a question by Yisroel last week about the personality of Rav Chaim Moser, because I forgot to mention that there's an amazing story about a non-religious Jew, maybe if he was from Columbus, Ohio, or Cincinnati, was very involved in the joint. He came to Vilna in 1939. Right before war broke out. And we have a memoir which discusses, I think it's maybe his memoir, I forget his name though. He, because of his meeting with Rav Chaim Moser and the Menschlichkeit he saw and the way Rav Chaim Moser dealt with him and spoke to him with such respect, even though he wasn't a pious person, the man was so inspired and he became religious. And then the rest of his life lived as a significant figure. I believe it was in Ohio. Also, I don't know. Oh, Shlomo, thank you. I don't know Mo Shmuel Schmidt. Thank you very much. I know Shlomo already. He's on top of all this stuff. Mo, I don't know the answer to that. Also, I'll tell you, Yisrael, since we dealt with Torah and Derech Eretz, if you look in Shlomo Karlbach's book, which we mentioned a number of times, he's the former Mashgiach of Chaim Berlin, the cousin of Shlomo Karlbach, the singer, the son of the rabbi of Hamburg, who was killed in the war. In his book, he deals about with the exportation, the exporting of Torah and Derech Eretz to Lithuania, and how they established a whole network of Torah and Derech Eretz schools in Lithuania. Not talking about one or two. We're talking about high schools, tens of high schools. It was called Yavna. And if you look on page 81 in this book, there's a letter there from the Rabbi Bakst, who was one of the great Rabbanim in Lithuania, in which he describes how he went to Rav Chaim Ozer, and Rav Chaim Ozer was very sympathetic to this whole notion of establishing Torah and Derech Eretz high schools in Lithuania. And in another generation, Lithuania was lost. These are not yeshivas. When it comes to Torah studies in yeshivas, Rav Chaim Ozer was firm. No secular studies, unless it's an absolute necessity, like in Germany, but certainly not in Lithuania or in the land of Israel. But in terms of high schools, vocational schools, schools for girls, he was very supportive of Torah and Derech Eretz. Not for everyone, but for many people. Remember, he's the God of Hador, and he says this. That's worth noting. No, not just in Germany. That's the novelty of the pre-war years in Lithuania, and why I stressed how it was really becoming a very moderate place. The Kovno Rav, spiritual leader of this movement, Rav Chaim Ozer, not only was not opposed, he was also expressed his support for this. Had there not been a Holocaust, Lithuania would have developed in a way similar to Germany, although with the great yeshivas, maybe like America. If you look at many of the great Rosh Yeshiva, their sons became academics, intellectual types, not in the Torah fashion. There was a Torah and Derech Eretz developing there that was cut short because of the Holocaust. And as I said, you can see all the details in Karlbach's book. What's great is that the Jewish Observer, in their last issue, before they went bust, they published Rabbi Yosef Beckhofer's review of this book, and there's an editorial note, and you can get it on Beckhofer's website, in which they say that before publishing this, they consulted with Gadolei Torah, who agreed that this is an important review and it should be included in the magazine. What do you mean, Amy? I don't remember any such article before I said that. But the point is that this review, obviously describing what's in the book, shows that this image that the yeshiva world tries to portray as if everything was Torah only and that's what the Gedolim wanted, the whole point of the book is to show that that wasn't the case and that the Gedolim were sympathetic towards Torah and Derech Eretz of a sort. Not in the yeshivas, but for the people, who's going to become, who are in yeshivas? 0.001% of Lithuanian young people were in yeshivas. What about the rest of the people? If you don't give them some sort of options, you're giving them a choice, either stay in the religious world or leave Orthodoxy. So there was a recognition that there had to be change. And precisely because the Aguda world, at least the editors, thought this might be something that the Gedolim might not want people to know about, they felt they had to consult. And in order to prevent themselves from being attacked, they actually published this clarification explaining why they would publish this. Now, with reference to all this, I received an email from David Zilberberg, who has been listening to our shows now a number of years. He's not on live with us, like busy, but he downloads them or he signs up. And in case I forget next class, let me just put another plug in. Download shows if you don't want to make a donation. You know, it's very difficult to run these things we have here, although they've become quite popular. We can't compete, obviously, with Torah and, with YU Torah, which has unlimited budget. But YU Torah doesn't have classes, interactive classes. They have lectures, but they have a lot of great stuff there. Rabbi Kelman, and then he has Shalom Eisenstadt and others who try to help out. So obviously, they do the best they can. And I would say even instead of making a donation, if you want to donate, instead of a $36 donation, you can download $36 worth of classes. We have a lot of good stuff there. But Rav Chaim, so he asks me a question. Well, he points out something fascinating, actually. Remember how we began this series on Rephaim Moser? I quoted Rabbi Soloveitchik as referring to Rephaim Moser as the paradigmatic Das Torah. And yet when the ultimate Das Torah, the Choshen, remember the Rephaim Moser represents the Choshen, the breastplate, when the ultimate Choshen question came to him, he declined to answer. And David asks me, doesn't that stand as repudiation of the Rav's thesis and the modern-day notion of Das Torah? And I would say, I don't think so. Das Torah doesn't mean that you're a prophet, you can decide everything. Rav Chaim Moser wasn't saying there's no room for Das Torah. He was simply saying that that should be Das Torah of the rabbis in Germany. So, but it is different than the contemporary Das Torah, I think, or maybe not. But then he says something else. He says, remember we spoke about the eulogy and how the Rav's eulogy is an implicit commentary on the ongoing battle between Mizrahi and Aguda. It's the Rav taking the side, obviously, of the Aguda. So then David asks me, doesn't the speech then become a poke in the eye of his father who backed Rubinstein? Remember we said his father backed Rubinstein? And that's a very good question, very good point. And it does seem to be a poke. Okay, on to Rav Chaim Moser. We ended last class about the boycott against Germany. How Agudas HaRabbanim in Germany and in Poland supported it, and Rav Chaim Moser opposed it. And he claimed that even the supporters of the boycott knew that it would do nothing to help Jews in Germany. It would only, they wanted to support a boycott to show the governments of Poland and Romania, places like that, that there will be consequences if you follow Germany in banning Shlita or anything like that. And Rav Chaim Moser argues that therefore the boycott is the wrong measure because Jews of Germany are opposed to it and they will be hurt by this. Germany is going to take there will be repercussions. Germany is going to take measures against them, which indeed happened. The famous boycott day. You've all seen the pictures of stormtroopers standing in front of Jewish stores holding signs, don't buy here, was in direct response to the boycott agitation outside of Germany. And Rav Chaim Moser said that we can't, just like Talmud says, we can't sacrifice A to save B, John Doe to save Jane Doe, so too we can't sacrifice German Jewry because of what might happen in another country. But once the Polish Agudas HaRabbanim, don't know it's part of Poland then, once the Polish Agudas HaRabbanim expressed their approval of the boycott, disagreed on this issue, Rav Chaim Moser agreed not to publicly oppose it. But not so his brother-in-law, Chanan Wasserman, whom we've spoken about a few times already. He was not one to keep his feelings to himself. And he continued to publicly oppose the boycott. And his reason is actually fascinating. He says that Jews must not launch any boycott against Germany because there is an oath. If you remember the three oaths we spoke about with the Satmar Rebbe, and one of the oaths is that Jews must not rebel against the nations. That is for an oath, that's literally or figuratively, but it's understood to be binding that Jews are forbidden to rebel against the nations. And this is a typical Gullus mentality. In this mentality, even Nazi Germany is a government which must be respected and is included among those in which Jews are forbidden to rebel, and launching a boycott against them falls under the category of rebelling against the nations. It's not your country, but it's another country, and you can't do that. Remember, we're speaking early 1933 here. We're not speaking about later in the Nazi years, and obviously not during the Holocaust. Now, why this is so fascinating is because for us today, if, let's say, the United States instituted some anti-Semitic decrees, we would all assume immediately that we no longer need to be loyal to it. It's no longer a valid government. It's an anti-Semitic government. They've instituted certain Jewish decrees. And therefore, Dina de Machusa doesn't apply. And yet that would be incorrect. Dina de Machusa, Dina, the law of the land is the law, is not voided because of government anti-Semitism. Until the creation of the United States, and even perhaps for some years after the creation, every government in history was anti-Semitic, to a greater or lesser extent. The laws of Dina de Machusa Dina were developed under the Romans and under the Babylonians, terribly anti-Semitic governments. Medieval times, the sages wrote about Dina Machusa Dina, terribly anti-Semitic situations. Every government in history was anti-Semitic, and no one ever said that the law of the land is not the law. In fact, if you look in the Ramah, the Choshen Mishpat, 369, Simon 369, number 6, it tells you that even if the government taxes the Jews more than the non-Jews, it still falls under the category of Dina de Machusa Dina. they do make a distinction, as the rabbis, between an acceptable level of anti-Semitism and an acceptable level of, I guess you'd say, persecution or second-class treatment, and an excessive amount of second-class treatment. Dina de Machusa Dina and Chamsa de Machusa. That is, if they put a tax on us more than the non-Jews, which, can you imagine if America today or any country in the West instituted a tax where we pay more than the non-Jews? No, I don't think any of us intuitively would feel that we're bound by this. And yet, according to the Shulchan Aruch, we would be bound. And yet, the sages distinguish between a little bit of persecution, let's say maybe if they gave us 5% more tax, and Chamsa, in which you have really expropriation and that real anti-Semitism. Let's say they all of a sudden began confiscating all our property or giving us a 50 or 60% tax on all. Then that would cross the line into, from the law of the land of the law, is to thievery. I would think, by the way, though, that if, let's say, hypothetically, a country, the United States, or a European country would pass a law taxing Jews more than anyone else or creating some sort of circumstance where we were discriminated against, I think you would find poskim who would argue, nevertheless, that Dina de Machusa Dina is not valid. How so? When I just said that every single government in history was anti-Semitic or prejudiced against Jews, and they all said Dina de Machusa Dina was valid, I think the post-sake would argue, at least if it was a more of a modern Orthodox post-sake, that in pre-modern times, when that's the way people thought, when Christianity was such a strong influence, then we can understand taxing Jews more than non-Jews. If you're in a society which is a religious society, the religion that is the second-class religion in law, it obviously has to be showed that it's a second-class religion through taxation or other means, through something like that. However, today, in the modern era, when we have more of an appreciation of human rights, and we've always fought it, and non-Jews have been opposed to Semitism, for a government to now revert to pre-modern mentalities, I think they would say that by definition that's invalid. Hopefully we'll never reach that place. At least that's how I think they would argue. So Rav Hanan was arguing that Germany still falls under the category of Dina de Machusa Dina, and therefore you must combat, he said, all evil decrees through the Shtadlan, through quiet diplomacy. That's been the way Jews always dealt with this problem. He wasn't the only one. The Gerer Rebbe actually suggested bribing the Nazis, shows that he didn't really understand that the Nazi regime is not a typical, not some prince in some part of Russia that you can just bribe, but not some corrupt petty official. But in response to Rav Hanan's point about the Jews being forbidden to rebel against the nations, Rav Chaim Ozer is known to have responded. We know this comes from Rav Henkin. As far as he says, Rav Henkin says this is famous, he thinks. He says it's famous. Rav Chaim Ozer responded to his brother-in-law that the Jews are also a nation. In other words, there comes a point when the Jews, too, can defend themselves. So Rav Chaim Ozer wasn't arguing that we didn't rebel against the nations or anything like that. He says that it's a mistake, strategically, to have a boycott because that'll hurt the Jews of Germany. If you recall the debate over the boycott against South Africa, just divestment, some people argue this is going to hurt the blacks. Rav Hanan's point was that we have to live like gullus Jews, and Rav Chaim Ozer says, but we too are a nation. Which means, as I said, that doesn't mean that they can just step on us. We're not in a cherry carte here. But they just step on us, and we have to say, thank you, can I have another? As I mentioned already, Rav Hanan Wasserman's writings are now reprinted by the Satmar, because some of his views are very much in line. I'm talking about what the Jews' place in the world vis-a-vis the non-Jews and Zionism. It really fits in very well with the Satmar approach. A few other things from Chaim Ozer. In his letters, and here is two volumes of his letters, thick volumes. They still miss a number of letters. I actually sent them some of the letters in here. Yaakov Rosenheim. Any letters to Yaakov Rosenheim. I sent some of them in here. In letter number 798, which is to Yaakov Rosenheim, which I didn't send them, I actually found a number of letters to Yaakov Rosenheim in, if you recall, the Sfarim blog. A long time ago, about a year and a half ago, I wrote about the Hillel, the Medallia archive. I found some letters in there, and I made copies of them, and then I put it back, and then that archive was destroyed. So that's where I found these letters. How they got there, I have no idea, but letters from Yaakov Rosen to from Chaim Moser to Yaakov Rosenheim, who's the world head of Agudas Yisrael. He writes to him about. Actually, sorry, I'll get to that in a second. The first thing I want to speak to about before I get to Yaakov Rosenheim is just briefly a letter in Rav Kook, number 798. That's the one, 798, is to Rav Kook about a yeshiva university in Israel, a plan to create a yeshiva university. Now, why did I bring this up? Only because if you saw the latest Torah Mada journal, there's a whole article about this very project. It begins, I don't know if he refers to this letter, that Rav Chaim Moser has heard that there's a plan to establish in Israel a college, like Yeshivas Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. He doesn't know if it's true. I think this probably has something to do with what that person writes about. And obviously, Rav Chaim Moser says that you have to oppose this. But getting back to what I said, what I was talking about, the letter to Yaakov Rosenheim and some others, the real problem was education of the young, not the yeshiva college or anything they're thinking about establishing. We spoke about how not only the German Orthodox who were associated with the Agudas Yisrael, but Jews in Poland and elsewhere were going to Israel, and Aliyah, and they wanted schools for their children in which there were secular studies. However, there was a ban on secular studies in the land of Israel. Now, it's true that by the 1930s, most people didn't hold to this ban, and there were plenty of schools with secular studies. The problem was that the Eda Haredit, which is the Agudas Yisrael segment in Jerusalem, in the land of Israel, they supported this. So what do you do when you're an Aguda person coming from Germany? You're bound when you're in Jerusalem by the Eda Haredit, and they're opposed to secular studies, and your kids need to be educated. What to do? And there's a long letter, it's number 800, to Yaakov Rosenheim. And we see from this letter a number of things. First of all, we see that he doesn't love the separatist approach. But before we get to that, in response to Yaakov Rosenheim, who did himself later go to Israel, he says to him that I haven't yet been asked officially by Agudas Yisrael what to do about the situation in Germany. And he says, until I'm asked, I don't want to do that. And he says, I'm not going to get involved. Apparently that... Rosenheim asked Rav Chaim Moser, and Rav Chaim Moser said, well, I have to be asked. And Rosenheim asks him, Rav Chaim Moser says, no, I'm not referring to a personal question. If someone asks me personally how to educate their children, he says, I have to be asked from Agudas Yisrael as an organization what to do. And he says, the problem is that in Israel, you have, in Eretz Yisrael, you have the situation where the Eda Haredit is saying that you can't have schools with secular studies. And then he says, the Chazon Ish, my great friend the Chazon Ish, he lives in Israel now, he lives in Bnei Brak, and he wrote to me that he can't get involved with this. And Rav Chaim Moser wanted the Chazon Ish to get involved in a number of things, and some of them he did. For example, the Pole Agudas Yisrael, he got involved with them and telling them how to run their in accordance with Halacha and Shemitah and all those things. But he says that it's difficult for the Chazon Ish writes to Rav Chaim Moser saying it's difficult for him to get involved because we don't push aside one life for that of another life. What is that? He says the people in the Yishuv HaYashan, the old-time Orthodox, the Eda Haredit, they still follow their old approach. And if we try to establish, this is what the Chazon Ish is saying to Rav Chaim Moser, a school that's going to have some secular studies, they claim that this is going to hurt them, and therefore we can't establish it because it's going to hurt them. On the other hand, we have all these people who are coming from outside the land of Israel, in fact, especially from Eretz Ashkenaz, from Germany, and as Rav Chaim Moser says, shum ofen, under no circumstances can they educate their children in accordance with the way of the Eda Haredit. And therefore, according to Lufidato, that is according to the Chazon Ish, kasha l'achlit bazeh. Chazon Ish says, I can't decide. If I decide in favor of schools with secular studies, the Eda Haredit will feel that I'm attacking them and destroying their lifestyle. And if I decide that you can't have secular studies, that'll destroy the German Orthodox and all the other ones who are coming, because there's no way in the world they can live with these old-fashioned schools. Chazon Ish says, I can't decide. But Rav Chaim Moser says, aval lo kein imadi. Rav Chaim Moser says, that's not true for me. I don't have that opinion that we can't make a decision. We must give an answer. But then he says, but until I'm asked, I'm not going to give an answer. So Rav Chaim Ozer is saying, it would have been very easy for him to say, let's keep going the old way. He's clear if you read him, he doesn't think that that's the approach. There's no one, none of the Aguda people who are going on Aliyah want to live like this. But he can't, until he's officially asked, he's not going to give his answer. And then he goes on to speak about separatism. Israel. Which is a lot of this, the same problems. He says that Rav Reuven Katz wrote to him. Rav Reuven Katz was one of his students. He was a Rav in Petah Tikva, not an Agudist. As I mentioned, most of these great rabbis who were either Agudistin or would have been associated with Aguda in Europe, when they came to Israel, they were not involved with the Aguda. Like I just said, because the Aguda in Israel was really Hungarian. It was very, very extreme. They couldn't stand the attacks on Rav Kook. There's a letter here from Chaim Ozer in which he writes to Rosenheim that he just got a letter from Rav Zalman Meltzer and Moshe Mordechai Epstein about what the Aguda Tzirim, the young Aguda people, were Kook. And it's as if he has to throw up when you read this. And it's a disgrace. He says it's destroying the organization. So that's what you were confronted with when you came to the land of Israel. So Reuven Katz says that Rav Chaim Ozer should come to Eretz Yisrael and solve the problem of the communities. Separatists, the Cook's school, Rav Kook's group, in Rav Kook's lifetime still, and the other group. And he says, well, you know, obviously we've seen that he can't do this, but then Rav Chaim Ozer says something very interesting, which is against the Eda Haredit approach. He says that in a place, let me read in Hebrew, Ro'oi Hayela Farsein, he says this to Rosenheim, who's the head of Agudas Yisrael. He says it should be made public. She'ein minui shel rav mitzad agudas Yisrael chova bimkom she'yesh rabbanim yirein mishleimim. That there, when you have good rabbanim, talmidei chachamim, even though they're not aguda, there's no, and we have to publicize this, that there's no need to appoint a separate aguda rabbanim, aguda rav. Why? He says because if you do that, tigadel hatirud v'hamachloket. Had people like the Eda Haredit and other Agudistin who thought that we need to have separate communities everywhere. And therefore, let's say you're in a city like Petach Tikva, so you have a general community and you have a Reuven Katz, who's the Rav. So therefore, they would say, the Aguda would say, just like they did in Hungary and Germany, don't accept Reuven Katz. We're going to have our own Rav. You do everything just like they did in Hungary and Germany. And Rav Chaim Ozer says no. When you have, even though he's going to say that I support the idea that you should be able to separate if you want to, that this is really only theoretical if you need to. In fact, he continues to say that we should fight for the ability to separate. However, if you have a situation where you have a good rav, not only shouldn't you separate, you have to make people know that this is not something to even strive for. We don't want to have a two rabbanim. He says, but if in the future there comes a time, yishorach b'davar, then we have to have the ability. Like, let's say the Zionists take over the community and we have a Rav who doesn't represent our interests, then we can separate. And then he goes on to say, so he says that he agrees with Aguda that we should create a situation government that a separatist community is a possibility, and as long as there's a separatist, that there's a possibility that if the wider community doesn't listen to the Orthodox and doesn't take into account their interests, we can always establish a separatist community, then that's enough. And if we have a valid Rav, a Talmud Chacham, and he's running the Kehillah properly, not only is there no obligation to establish a separate Rabbanus there, but you can establish one, because that's just creating machlokes. So you see here that Rav Chaim Ozer is expressing the interest and the value system of the Lithuania, who never had separatist communities. Moshe Blau, in his book Mikatavitz ad Hebe'ir, which is really a great book by a Haredi historian, original documents, it's very rare to have a Haredi write real history. He discusses this, and he acknowledges that Rav Chaim Ozer, it's on page 324, Rav Chaim Ozer, unlike the Aguda in the land of Israel and Hungary, did not think it was proper to in every place establish a Kehila Haredit Nifredet. In his opinion, if you can keep a separate community, keep a separate community. But then he says that nevertheless, he did come to the conclusion that that we have to demand the ability to have a separate communities because we might need them. See already, the Rav Chaim Ozer is a very different viewpoint. He was asked another question. This is letters 823. This was during the time the first discussions over a partition of the land of Israel. And the first partition proposal was 1937, the Peel proposal. And here you see what the state of Israel was supposed to look like. Very much in line with the 1948 partition and very much in line with what came after the 1948 war, except for in the north. Right up here, obviously, that remained Israel, and also down here, that became Israel, and also down here. The question Rav Chaim Ozer was asked, and he was asked a number of times, there's a few letters about this, was, is it forbidden to accept this proposal publicly? What's the problem? Well, Jews are not allowed to give up part of the land of Israel. Can't sell the land of Israel permanent to non-Jews or give it up. And therefore, by accepting this plan, they would be saying that we're giving up part of the land of Israel. And it's really, I think, a foolish question, but a number of people asked him, and Chaim Ozer says it's not a real question. Because it's not like we have the land and we have a choice to give it up. We don't own the land. The land is owned by the British, or it's controlled by the British, and they're giving us an option. Take this or take nothing. So obviously there's no halacha question. But he then does discuss in letter number 825 his thoughts about the establishment of a homeland. This too is quite interesting. At the beginning of the letter, he deals with what should be the Jewish approach, the political approach. If the British offer this plan, this proposal, the Peel proposal, which was 1937, and his letters are from 1937, so he's responding to this. If we accept this proposal as is, well, we might get it, or then at the end of the day, it might be even smaller. On the other hand, if we demand more, then after negotiations, we might end up with more, or, you know, it could lead to nothing. So it's not clear how to decide this. And Rav Chaim Ozer himself says it's hard to know what the answer is. For someone who supposedly has Das Torah in every decision, he is so honest and so humble in case after case, in numerous cases we're not dealing with, in acknowledging that he doesn't know the answer here. It's a hard problem. I'll give you some other cases as well. He begins here. Hineni navoch gamani me'od haron she'elach hamurazol. Not sure, and he doesn't tell you. He says this is a political question. That's nogat l'kal Yisrael, v'kasha l'potra. He says it's hard to solve this. So just like he couldn't solve the problem of separate communities in Germany, he says because it's hard to find real sources for this. He says, what can we do in this orphan generation? We don't have the great sages of the past. And then he goes on to say, though, that our position needs to be that we need to do that which is best for Batamenu Datkachenu, whatever will be best for the benefit of the Jewish people and the Jewish religion. That, of course, is going to be the real problem. What's going to be best for them? And in terms of separating the land, in terms of accepting a partition proposal, because some people said we don't want this at all. There were the anti-Zionist position. And he's dealing with the anti-Zionist position also here. Do we say we don't want to have any state? We just want the British to continue ruling it. He says it's doubtful if the Yishuv can really expand properly in the proposed state of Israel. And then he goes on. He says they're surrounded by enemies who have made clear their determination what to do with the Jews. So we already see that Rav Chaim Ozer is skeptical about whether they should even accept it, not just accept it as a matter of strategy, should they ask for more, but whether they should accept the proposal. Because it's questionable whether you can even bring the Yishuv there. I'm not sure what he's referring to by that, maybe just economically. But then he says the security problem, which is why Rav Henkin, as we saw, was skeptical about a state, because he thought that it could lead to another genocide. This is before the Holocaust, obviously, Rav Chaim Ozer, but he thought it was very dangerous there. And he says that people, some of the Zikne Hayushal, the old timers in the land of Israel, also didn't want to create a state. He's talking about the Orthodox ones, many people in Agudas Yisrael. They were happy to live under British rule. And then he goes on and says, and what about the Jewish religion? He says, if the secularists will rule, and obviously they would, they were the majority, the overwhelming majority, who knows where that will lead to. So we see a real problem, and in another letter, which he says, he writes to Moshe Blau, who was the head of Agudas Yisrael, the brother of Amram Blau, the Mitzvah person, Moshe Blau was the head of Agudas Yisrael in Poland, he deals with this further, and he says that if the British come out in favor of giving the Jews land, then the Agudas Yisrael has to get in front and also support the state. Because if they don't, and then the state's established, they've lost an enormous amount. However, if the British are not officially on record as supporting the establishment of the state, Chaim Ozer's position was, keep quiet. Don't come out in favor, don't say anything. And I do get the sense from his letters that this was his preferred position. And in the 1930s, he would have preferred a situation where the British continue ruling as a mandate. And the real issue for him is that the non-religious are going to create a non-religious state. And Rav Chaim Ozer preferred living in a non-Jewish state in which the Orthodox are given complete religious freedom and ability to develop their lifestyle than in a Jewish state led by the anti-religious. Great fear that... I'm not going to say it to the extent of what happened, obviously, in the Soviet Union. I'm not referring to that, where you had the Jewish anti-religious elements. But there was great fear that with a state of Jews, led by Jews who were rebelling against Judaism, traditional Jewish life would be very difficult. And it would be preferable to live in a situation where an enlightened kingdom, an enlightened ruler, like the British, would allow Jewish life to develop. And then over time, if the Orthodox become a majority, you can think about having a state. But in the 1930s, and it would clearly become a secularist state, you have to think of the state of Israel not like the way it is today, full of yeshivas and everything like that. Think of an era where when Ben-Gurion spoke to the Chazon Ish, there was 600 people, I think, running full-time in yeshivas. Think of an era before the Holocaust, when you had that great aliyah of Orthodox Jews from places like Hungary. Think of in the 1930s, where it really was run... Other than Jerusalem and Tveria, it was very much a non-Orthodox state. There's a fear that this isn't just going to be a state of the Jews, a non-religious state of the Jews. It's going to be a state in which Orthodoxy is very much put on the defensive. So I think you have to say that Rav Chaim Ozer, I wouldn't call him anti-Zionist, a non-Zionist, and with a preference for keeping the status quo. However, if the British show that they're serious about creating a state, then Agudas Yisrael has to be out front in support, because if you're not there at the takeoff, you won't be there at the landing. And once again, we see how he differs from his brother-in-law, Rochanan Wasserman, who to the end believed that Agudas Yisrael opposed the creation of a state. And in 1938, at the conference in Marienbad, 1937, the Agudas Yisrael officially came out in support of a state, of course, with Torah values, but a state. And that's because it was clear that after the partition that was offered, that was the direction they were moving in. In a letter to Rav Herzog, Rav Yitzhak Herzog becomes very much a correspondent of Rav Chaim Ozer. In fact, from the letters, it appears that they became quite close, although I don't think they ever met. Herzog becomes chief rabbi in 1936, I think he takes his position officially, maybe even 1937, and he immediately begins, or 1937, he might have moved there, Hope dies in 1935, he immediately begins corresponding with Rav Chaim Ozer about all the issues about the future state. And in letter 827, similarly about accepting of a state, and can we accept a portion of the land? And Rav Chaim Ozer writes to him that we believe in the prophets, and in the end everything will come to be. The land that is ours will come to us. But there's no prohibition to accept the proposal, if that's what we decide we should do. And then he says, I agree with you, Rav Herzog, that today, and he's writing this in 1938, all the Orthodox parties should come together. What doesn't appear in the letters, but which Rav Herzog's secretary, Yaakov Goldman, reports, is that when they were offered this, the field proposal, the one I'm showing you in the picture right now, a number of rabbis, together with Rav Herzog and his father-in-law, Rav Shmuel Yitzhak Hillman, they did the Goral Hagra. The Vilna Gaon has a famous lottery or Goral that's attributed to the Gra, that you open up the Bible and you find a verse on the page, you open it up, and that speaks to you. That's the answer to your question. So they did the Goral Hagra has been done a few times. As far as I know, no one's ever written an article on the Goral Hagra. I think the most famous example of the Goral Hagra was Rav Aryeh Levin after the destruction at Gush Etzion. And they had to identify the soldiers. C. Pesach Frank told him to do the Goral Hagra. And if you look in the book at Tzadik in Our Time, you have a whole description of this. So they did the Goral Hagra, and it fell on the verse in Genesis 18:4, Yikach na ma'at mayim. Take a little bit of water. So what's ma'at? They derive from ma'at mayim a little bit, that if given something, you take a little. If we're given the option of taking small state, which is no state, take what we can get. By the way, the newspaper Hatzofer, Faber the Mizrahi from 1937 until it carried a report in 1938 of the Chazon Ish's view on this very issue of accepting the partition. At the time, the Chazon Ish wasn't so famous, but he replied that all these people who are saying that you can't agree to the division, since we can't give Arabs the land. There were people who said that you can't agree, we have to go for everything because we cannot give up any part of the land. He said that these were the very same people as the super Zionists. They also agreed with the Heter Mechira. They agreed with selling the land to the Arabs during the sabbatical year, and even the Chazon Ish says, and this is a biblical violation. I don't think it's such a question, because if you ask these people, they would say, and this is the whole basis of the Heter Mechira, that it's a temporary sale. None of these people supported Heter Mechira supported a permanent sale. It was a temporary sale, but that's what the Chazon Ish said. Now, Rav Herzog consulted with Rav Chaim Ozer about all sorts of matters. How to run a modern state. Repeat now some of what I mentioned in the discussions about Rav Herzog, because many... How do you run a modern state? How do you deal with the court system? Rav Herzog calls attention to a very interesting theory of the wrong. Rav Nissim of Girona, says that we have in our Torah system two types of governance. We have Torah law and the law of the king. What is he referring to? Well, take a look at how difficult it is to convict people in Jewish law. You need to have two witnesses, they need to be warned. How can you run a state like this? How can you run a society? How can you put people in jail? I tell you that every single person in jail, without exception, according to Torah law, should not be in jail. First of all, there is no jail in Torah law, but let's say we have jails. Every one of these people were convicted based on trials in which evidence was presented. None of these people were given warning of any sort before they committed their crime. So how can you run a state like this? One thing, we have to have a Torah state, we have to run Torah law, but you can't run a state like that. Obviously, the medievals were aware of this, the Chazal were aware of this, and the Ron was aware of this. Now, the standard view, is what you'll find in the Rambam and elsewhere, is that Beis Din has the authority to basically do whatever they want to do as emergency measures. This is based on this notion that of Hokasha, they cited the famous passage in the Talmud where rabbis executed someone for riding a horse on Shabbos, even though that's only a rabbinic prohibition, executed for that. But in order to establish Torah law, you're allowed to break with, the rabbis have the authority to break with the Torah law and do extrajudicial measures. So therefore, Beis Din can do whatever it needs to do. That's the way society worked in medieval times. In Spain, there was all sorts of punishments they gave people, which according to Torah law, they shouldn't be. But the Ron had a different perspective on it. He said, as I said, there's two types of governance. There's Torah law and the law of the king, what I call realistic law. And they operate in two separate spheres. So, for example, according to Torah law, you need two witnesses to convict someone. But the law of the king can set up any sort of proof it wants. And the law of the king means governmental law. Now, according to the Ron, by the way, this is an authority only granted to the Sanhedrin, not to the religious leaders. And this is how he explains, by the way, the sin of the Israelites when they asked for a king in the days of Samuel. It was that they wanted the king to have absolute control. In other words, that Torah law would have no value whatsoever. There just would be the law of the king. And that was their problem. Had they just wanted law of the king, in addition to Torah law, they wouldn't have had done anything wrong. In the Ron's conception, the Torah laws still apply, but the king, or the ruler, acting to establish order, creates a parallel legal system. This is Drush 11. And as I said, if you look at how difficult it is to convict people in Jewish law, being required to give warning ahead of time, you can conclude, I think, that the Torah law is really only meant as some sort of theoretical or Rosh Kabbal Sar type of deception, because it's clearly impossible to run any sort of society based on Torah law. It's almost a messianic type of law, not meant for the real world, and maybe that's what it is. In the messianic era, where you don't have people really committing all these crimes, this is the sort of system we can have, but in our pre-messianic world, where you need, obviously, deterrence, you need to have the king's law, and hopefully we're striving for more of Torah law, which is a messianic type of law. Now, for the Ron, laws of the Beis Din, when it comes to judging criminals, are religious law. All the things we learned about in yeshiva, how you need the two witnesses and the warning, all these things, these are religious law. Not any different than the avodah, than the service in the Beis HaMikdash. They are designed to fulfill a religious duty with all its entails. But they don't actually lead to convictions, and they're not meant to lead to convictions. It's like Kiddush HaChodesh. In ancient times, they used to do Kiddush HaChodesh, the sighting of the new moon, even though they knew when the new moon was. Yet they still went through the procedure of Kiddush HaChodesh, of sanctifying the new moon, even though they didn't have to because they knew, based on a calendar, when the new moon was. Yet it was a religious ritual, a religious ceremony. Similarly, according to the Ron, it's a mitzvah to judge the criminal first in front of a religious court, even if you know he will not be guilty according to the Torah. After you finish judging him in front of a religious court, then you bring him in front of Beis Din. In front of the king, and the king will judge him according to whatever way the king wants to judge him. I see the hour's getting late, but I'm going to finish. If I even have to go 5 minutes over, I want to finish this issue. In fact, I'm going to go 10 minutes over. Those who can't stay on, you can get the tape, obviously, and watch the last 10 minutes, because I do want to finish with Chaim Ozer today. Now, throughout history, as I mentioned, Jewish courts have diverged from strict Torah law when the times required it. However, for the Ron, not talking about an emergency action, ad hoc measure. You're talking about a complete parallel legal system. And I've mentioned before that many people are unaware of this. And they actually think that if you don't have two witnesses warning someone, that you can never convict. And I always think that this is a disgrace to the Torah, because it makes people think that Jewish law cannot function in the real world. You know, you're in yeshiva, you learn about all these things you need to do. I wrote about this on the Spine blog, about the case in Florida, that the murderer in Florida, where anyone with half a brain, they're in yeshiva and they learn all the laws, and that's it. That's all they're told about how a Jewish system will function. They will have to conclude that basically Jewish law is not suitable for a real society. You can't run society based on Jewish law. And because how can you have a society where you can't send criminals to jail? And therefore, I think it's a real bizarre, it's a real disgrace, because obviously Jewish law can function. It has functioned. And if you want to know how Jewish law has functioned throughout history, you have to look at the responsa literature. And there you see exactly what the Rush and the Rashba and all the great medievals did when they had, and in Germany, when they had to deal with criminals, adulterers, thieves, everything. They did what they needed to do. And in fact, some of the punishments that were quite barbaric from our perspective. Cutting off noses, terrible things. Yitzhak Baer discusses this in Jews of Christian Spain, and he's very happy to be able to say, in his mind at least, that that these were all punishments taken from the Spanish legal system, because obviously it hurts him to say, he doesn't want to say that this could actually be from Jewish rules. And I'm happy to say that I agree with him also. I hate to think that Judaism would sanction these sorts of tortures, although in a society, you don't want to execute someone, and you don't have jails, and you have to punish the person. I guess cutting off an organ or torturing them is better than killing them. All the people who are against torture, if the option was torture versus capital punishment, where would they come down in that case? In fact, I've even heard Talmidei Chachamim speak about how in the Jewish legal system, none of these people we see convicted could ever be convicted. And as I said, it really is a bizayon to the Jewish law, because it makes people then are justified in concluding that Jewish law is not practical and it has no this worldly value. By the way, there's a great tshuva, Tzitz Eliezer, who goes through all the different elements and how Jewish law functioned and how the courts were able to punish people, etc., etc. And Simcha Asaf has an entire book, Ha'onshin Acharei Chatimat the Talmud, Punishments After the Close of the Talmud. So how did the Ron fit into this all? Because Rav Herzog writes, Chaim Ozer, how to run a state. Rav Herzog actually believed naively that there was a possibility that criminal law would be run according to Jewish law. So therefore, all these problems are going to come. We're planning for the new state. What are you going to do? How are we going to have courts and jails and convict people and everything like that? Chaim Ozer writes back to him. This is the number 837 in the letters, that you have to use the Ron's conception. And he says that there was a Mishpat HaMelucha separate from the Beis Din that judges according to Torah. And why? Rav Chaim Ozer says as follows. Ki be'emet kasheh hadavar l'takanat ha'medina sh'aganav yiftar atzmo b'keifo u'modeh b'knas yipater l'gamri. Rav Chaim Ozer says as follows. How can you have a society in which if you have a thief, what is the Torah law? According to Torah law, what's the punishment for a thief? You pay double. Where's the deterrence in that? I can rob from 10 people, and if I happen to get caught on the 11th, fine, I pay back double, and I'm still ahead. Or if I'm rich, I can rob as much as I want, because if I'm ever caught, fine, I pay back double. It's not going to affect me. And if before trial, if you confess, that is, you go free. And obviously, you can't have a society like this. Every criminal would confess. So Rav Chaim Ozer says, we have to therefore adopt the government, the state, whatever state is established, they would be able to punish in however way they see fit, through jails, etc., etc. And he says, Al Kain, Shebichon Zet, Sarichot HaKain, Takanot HaMedina, Inyan Beitin Makin Ve'onshin. That's what the Talmudic phrase, that Beis Din can lash people and punish them, not in accordance with Chaim Ozer says, that's what you need to do. You need to establish all sorts of laws. And as the Ron says, there's Torah law, but that's not how society really functions. I guarantee you that if I go into moshuls to speak to people, even learned Talmidei Chachamim, people who have only learned the Talmud and maybe the Rambam, but not the responsible literature, and say that Jewish law is not practical, and that if we had a Torah state, we'd have to punish people in non-Torah ways, they would say I'm some sort of heretic, etc., etc. The amount of ignorance on this issue of how Jewish society has not only has functioned, they've been autonomous, but how the Rishonim wrote about, and also Rav Chaim Ozer and the Acharonim, how it should function if they had autonomy, I don't know of any area in which there's such ignorance as in this area. Every time there's a court case or an issue that's on the blogs or the news, and you hear all these people talking about how, well, you need the two witnesses, and this person can't be punished because he wasn't warned, etc., you see again that the people just are unaware of how these things work. And according to the Ron, this is not actually to be seen as usurping Torah law, because this is basic to any society, that there's types of law. Rav Chaim Ozer, really, he's not accurate, I think, in what I just quoted from you, because he merges the Rambam's view of Beit Din, Makin, Ve'onshin, Shalom, Min Hadin. This is how the Rambam and others deal with this issue. That the Beis Din, on its own, can, when the time needs it, they can establish any sort of punishment they want to. But the Ron is not speaking about the Beis Din, and he's not speaking about any sort of emergency measure. He's speaking about a totally separate parallel legal system that is there from the beginning, which is there on Torah imprimatur. That is, the Torah wants you to have this separate legal system. And according to Torah law, he claims that there are two types of law. There's technical Torah law, and then there's the law of the king, which is under the Torah rubric. Speaking theologically, I think you can say that the Torah, that is the strict Torah law, how we punish people, is what we strive for. It would be nice to have a society based on this. We could start a kibbutz like this, but in the real world, we need courts with real authority. Rav Herzog actually opposes Rav Chaim Moser on this. Rav Herzog doesn't want to adopt the view of the Ron, because then there'd be no need for the rabbinate or halacha at all. Everything. Remember, what is Rav Chaim Moser saying? He's saying, use the Ron. There's a parallel legal system. Whatever the base to the stat, whatever the court establishes, or the king, the state, that's how you'll punish people. Chaim Moser, however, wants to create a state which actually uses halacha. By adopting the Ron's conception, you're throwing in the towel, acknowledging that a Torah state cannot be run according to traditional Jewish law. And that is what the Ron's point is, and that's what Rav Chaim Moser is saying. But Rav Herzog, from his perspective, rather than creating a parallel legal system, like the Ron says, you see what you can do within the Torah system. You work within the Torah system, and if you have to make an emergency takana here, you make it. If you have to make something on an extrajudicial measure here, you do it. But you do it only in an ad hoc basis for each case. You don't establish from day one an alternate legal system, the law of the king, which has no connection to Torah law at all. No, you work within the Torah system as much as you can, and on ad hoc measures, then you depart from it when you need to hamid et hadat al tilat, to establish justice and the religion, etc. Truth is that the difference between Rav Herzog and Rav Chaim Moser is fairly ideological here. Rav Herzog thinks Rav Chaim Moser is giving up without even trying. He's saying you have a new state, so function like the Ron. Rav Chaim Moser, however, has no stake in the soon-to-be-established state. He just saw this as a state of the Jews, but there's nothing Jewish about this state because it was going to be run by the non-religious. So if the religious are able to have some influence to establish some Jewish laws, fine, and otherwise, fine, then we'll say whatever laws the non-religious establish, that's the Ron system. It's the law of the king, and that'll bind everyone. There's no messianic element, there's no religious element. Rav Herzog, however, he views this future state that's coming in messianic terms. This is going to be the beginning of the redemption. So for him to say, well, this is just like any other secular state, we'll just function by whatever law they establish, because that's what the Ron says. You can function by whatever law is set up. That, to him, is a terrible way to go. I think the difference is that for Chaim Moser, this new state of Israel that's going to be coming soon, what is it? It's a group of non-religious Jews that are establishing a state. It has no religious significance. For Rav Herzog, it was vital to try to put Torah law in, to try to make the state have some sort of Torah component. Rav Chaim Moser, by the way, repeats his viewpoint about the Ron in a letter to Rabbi Yochanan Wasserman. And in this letter, he gives another example of why we need the Ron. He says, by the way, that the Nesivos, I have to check this, in his drushos, Nachos Yaakov agrees with the Ron. But he says that it's very difficult to have a society in which, there's all sorts of damages that according to Torah law, you're not be responsible for. And then at the end of this letter, though, he says, there's a problem, though. What do we do about Jews and non-Jews? Because when it comes to non-Jews, the Rambam already says that they can establish their own courts. So in this new state that's going to be established, you have Jewish courts for the Jews and non-Jewish courts for the non-Jews. What do you do when Jews and non-Jews have cases together? And this is what he says. He says, he says, it's not clear whether in such a case there's a problem about going to the non-Jewish judges. That is, he's not clear. He thinks it needs to be determined, but it's possible that even in this new state, in which you'll have non-Jewish judges for the non-Jews, that if a Jew and a non-Jew have a case, it could be that it's possible for the Jew to say, okay, we'll be judged by the non-Jewish judge. Obviously, in a if two Jews have a case, we can only be judged by a Beis Din. We can't be judged by a secular or by a non-Jewish judge. But Rav Chaim Ozer is unclear about if it's a Jew or for a non-Jew, does the fight to have the case heard in Beis Din? There have been cases where non-Jews thought they would get a fair shake in Beis Din, so they preferred going to Beis Din. But he's not sure whether that's something we need to fight for. It could just be that, no, you can go before the non-Jew. I see it's 10:10. I only have two more points, so let me just quickly finish it up, and then we'll be done with Rav Chaim Ozer. Another interesting tshuvot in the last volume of Achiezer, the most recently published volume, manuscript, posthumous volume, he was asked if Birkas Kohanim should be canceled, if Kohanim, not Shomer Shabbos. And in that responsum, he quotes Rabbi Jacob Ettlinger, if you remember my class on Jacob Ettlinger, that we have a new phenomenon in modern days, that is the God-fearing Sabbath violator. Binyan Sion spoke about what's going on in Germany, and obviously you had this in Lithuania. You have people who violate Shabbos, but yet still feel strongly about Judaism. They'll go to shul in the morning and violate Shabbos in the afternoon. These are not the people that the Talmud spoke about when they said that a Sabbath violator is akin to an idolater, in that he basically has no religious significance. We can't count him in anything, and he's really left our community. That was referring to an era when Shabbos violation was such a break with convention, when everyone was observant. And breaking Shabbos, it shows that you want nothing to do with the Jews. Today, however, it's very different. The Shabbos violators are the majority. And people violating Shabbos don't see this as any problem. They don't see this as a rejection of Judaism. And therefore, Rav Chaim Ozer adopts the Binyan Sion's position that the Shabbos violator is to be judged differently today. And finally, let me just mention, Chaim Ozer is famous. This is quoted by many people. Soloveitchik quoted it, or C.P. Frank and others. He would use an electric light bulb instead of a Havdalah candle. This is a question always, can you use an electric light bulb? I think most people think you can use an electric light bulb. I've used an electric light bulb many times. They say you can't use a fluorescent light bulb, but you can use I don't really understand the difference, but that's what they say. They say you can't use a fluorescent light bulb. Although, presumably, Tamei Chachamim online could correct me if I'm wrong, assuming you can use an electric light for Shabbos candles, and people like Rav Shechter actually think that that's the real light, the electric light, I don't see any problem using a fluorescent light, because the whole point is light. But whatever, when it comes to Havdalah, they say it can't be fluorescent. I don't know how the fluorescent light works, so I don't know. But Rav Chaim Ozer would always use an electric light for Havdalah. People who are with Rav Chaim Ozer actually testified to this. And they say he did this to stress that electricity, which hadn't been around for that long, feel fire. We need something that qualifies as, quote, halachic fire for Havdalah candle. You had many people in his day who were saying, well, obviously we can't light a match on Shabbos, but electricity, that's something new. That wasn't around in the days of the rabbi. That's not real fire. Just look at the conservative tshuvot on electricity. You'll get all the arguments that people were using, not in the Orthodox community, but in the non-Orthodox, and I guess the semi-religious were saying things like that. Not only the semi-religious, if you look in Salas Deitchus, the son of the great Yisrael Chaim Deitchus, the Gaon of Leeds, great Yerushalmi scholar, it mentions there, in the autobiography of his grandson, David Deitchus, he says that his father, who was the Rav of Edinburgh, an Orthodox Rav of good standing, he would turn lights on Shabbos because he had this argument also. So Rav Chaim Ozer would use electricity for Havdalah candle to show everyone, don't think that electricity is not real fire. It is real fire. And just like we can use it now for Havdalah, you cannot use it on Shabbos for that very reason. And Ratzi Pesach Frank also quotes the Rugged Shover of having the same opinion and using an electric light for Havdalah to stress that electricity is real fire. And you can't use it on Shabbos. Rav Abadi, let's get back to how we began. Rav Abadi holds it's not real fire. He holds that it's a question whether it's even a likely it's a derabbanan, turning on lights, and therefore he permits you to open the refrigerator, heat to on Shabbos. Obviously, if you hold it's real fire, you couldn't just refrigerator at the turn off the light. It's a much more difficult circumstance. Okay, we'll end here. We've gone a little over, but I did want to conclude because I wanted to have at least one talk this semester to whet our appetites to deal with another amazing person, Elijah Ben Amozig, so we can devote all of next week, and next week is the last class we have this semester, to Elijah Ben Amozig, and that's what we'll do next class. So let me just take a few questions here, comments if we have. Charles is going to explain to me the physics of this. The light is emitted directly from the element. The fluorescent light. Okay, that makes sense. Although, my problem is I don't exactly know why this should matter. Dealing with electricity, and you're trying to. So does that mean that if you turn on a fluorescent light bulb, it's only a rabbinic prohibition? I'm not sure why. I guess the problem is I don't exactly know issues of electricity so much. Supposedly, one of the YU Rosh Yeshiva said that no one can really explain why electricity is forbidden. And I don't know. There's plenty of articles. You can see an article by Rabbi Jachter and Broyd all about electricity, but I've never really been able to understand the issue. They make all these analogies. And I think it might come back to what Rabbi Asher Weiss said about the Chazon Ish, that the Chazon Ish started with this intuitive feeling, knowing that electricity was forbidden. And then he just had to show why it was forbidden, but came intuitively, I guess, Das Torah, however you want to put it. It's not so clear about electricity. Lights, you have another issue about creating lights. There's another problem there, although I don't know that would make it a Torah prohibition. We all know Rishon Zalman Arbach's position that electricity, that in which light is not emitted, he doesn't really see why it's prohibited at all. I do think that one day we might have to come back to these leniencies of Rishon Zalman Arbach, which is only a theoretical position, because what's going to be in 50 years? And you're not going to be able to get into any apartment building about some sort of electric thing, when every toilet is going to function electrically, when we literally will not be able to function anything in our lives without electricity. I would not be surprised, we won't be alive probably for that time, but I would not be surprised if the post-scheme are going to have to resurrect this viewpoint from Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that if no heat or light is emitted, there really is no prohibition. So when Shlomo Zalman Auerbach spoke about this, what was he dealing with? A fan or something like that? So we don't need these fans. We have air conditioning, and that's not a necessity. But if you're dealing in a situation where literally it becomes pretty much impossible to live without using electricity, because granted, there'll be people whose businesses will become maybe Shabbos houses, but still, you're going to have situations where it becomes almost impossible to function without some sort of using electricity. I would not be surprised if in that era, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's position, in contrast to the Chazon Ish, is resurrected, that really in emergency to measure times when we have no other choice, we can rely on this idea that if no heat or light is emitted, that electricity is not really a prohibition, maybe not a prohibition. As I said, we won't be around those either. But I do, thank you, Yisrael, I do confess my ignorance, because I don't exactly understand why, I don't know enough about Hilchos Shabbos, perhaps, why this should affect anything, light or not. Any other questions or comments before we break? Shlomo, anything we need to point out for next class? Did he have any correspondence with the Rugged Shover? As far as I know, he had no correspondence with the Rugged Shover. But during the great dispute of Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg and the Rugged Shover that I described in my book, and next class I'm going to tell you some more about Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg and the Rugged Shover from the new edition of Lifarkim that just came out recently. In the dispute where the Rugged Shover basically degraded Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg and him like he was a nobody, Rabbi Chiyak of, the question was, you had two brothers. One was an apostate to Christianity and one was a non-religious man. Who should do the chalitza? And Weinberg thought it should be the non-religious man, and the Rugged Shover thought it didn't, and that was more problematic because he was harder to get to him, and the Rugged Shover thought it didn't matter because a non-religious person is no different than an apostate, and Weinberg thought this was a very dangerous viewpoint. But almost all the Gedolim agreed with Weinberg, and he went to Rav Chaim Ozer, and Rav Chaim Ozer refuted refused to get involved. He knew who he'd be messing with, and he didn't want to mess with the rubbish of her. So they didn't have any correspondence, as far as I know. There is a famous story where the rugged shover and Rav Chaim Ozer were together. And they got in some argument, and the rugged shover threw a chair at Rav Chaim Ozer. Is that one of the mentions? I don't know, Shlomo, who knows a lot about the... The Shlomo official is, from our correspondence, I know that he knows a lot about these stories. I believe he knows, you who we would correspond about this, you know exactly which conferences took place in. I think the Making of a Gadol describes this. It's a famous story. I heard it from Louis Jacobs also. I don't know if it's a true story because I don't know if anyone else was in the room. But yet, the story is told, at least, that the Rabbi Shover got so angry that he threw a chair at Chaim Ozer. But I do not know if they had any correspondence. First of all, the rugged shover didn't need to need judge scholarship by looking at it. And if the rugged shover was such a genius that no one measured up, how did Bamberger judge it? Bamberger wasn't an idiot. He lived in Germany. He saw that Hirsch was writing commentaries on Chumash and doing other things, and Bamberger was writing traditional Talmudic works. Hirsch had studied for a couple years intensively in traditional environments, and the rest of his time, his learning was not full-time. So you sort of get a sense, even as an outsider, of those people. I mean, Yisrael, let's be realistic here. If I point out to you someone who's been in Lakewood 25 years just studying and compare him to a typical pulpit rabbi from any yeshiva, someone who was in yeshiva for a few years and then has been out in the rabbinate for the last 20 years. It's pretty obvious to know that the guy from Lakewood who's been working 5 years knows more than the pulpit rabbi. It doesn't mean that he's a better posek. It could be the pulpit rabbi's better because he's on the scene. He's involved with people. He understands the world. But if you just ask me who knows how to learn better, who knows more, so Bamberger was the posek acharon in Germany. He was the greatest posek. No one disputed that. The people in Frankfurt wouldn't dispute that. However, as Hirsch said, it's precisely because Bamberger is so removed from Torah and Derech Eretz that he can make such egregious error. And you're going to compare the rugged shover to Weinberg or to anyone? The rugged shover knew how great he was. It's true. You can't compare. I'm not going to compare Rav Soloveitchik versus Rav Moshe Feinstein. But if you take one of the secondary Rosh Yeshiva, I'm not going to say any names because it's not important, but just take anyone on the Moetz Gedolia Torah today. Israel, is anyone going to compare them to Moshe Feinstein, Soloveitchik? I mean, you're talking about major leagues versus minor leagues. I don't think anyone would have any question about this. In fact, I know no one would. So we can get a sense over. Samuel Johnson is quoted as saying that we all know what daylight is, and we all know what darkness is. That's clear. We don't know what dusk is. Dusk is what's problematic. But just because we can't determine exactly when dusk becomes daylight and when daylight becomes dusk, I mean, when dusk becomes darkness or when daylight becomes dusk, that doesn't mean we don't know what darkness is and what light is. It's just that in the middle there, there's some problems. So, yes, it's true that you're not going to compare Feinstein to Rav Yashin and say who's greater. I mean, this is something, but because that's dusk. We shouldn't even try to do that. But that doesn't mean we don't know what darkness is and what light is. That doesn't mean that we can't say that the Rav Moshe Feinstein is greater than your local rabbi down the street. So that's all I'm saying. Okay. Then I see no more questions, no more comments. Shlomo, do you have anything to say about this, the throwing of the chair, the famous story of the rugged shover? I'll for one more minute to see if Shlomo has an answer, because maybe it wasn't Shlomo I discussed this with. Okay, well then, if not, let's end here. Pick it up next week. Move back to Italy.